So welcome back. I hope you all enjoyed your walking meditation. So we've been looking at impermanence. And of course the biggest manifestation of impermanence is death. The biggest manifestation of impermanence is death. Now, I've said to you before, but each of these topics, we're lucky because the FPMT run courses and study groups on all of this. In fact, I've just finished at Land of Joy not so long ago, a 3-day, was it 4 days, can't remember, 3 or 4 days, 3.5 days, something like that, on just on death, nothing but death. Very joyful. It was an extremely joyful time. So what we'll start with is looking at an overview from a Buddhist perspective. Okay, just an overview. So from a Buddhist perspective, we have two types of bodies. Right? We've got the gross body and we've got the subtle body. And the subtle body is made up of channels, winds and drops within the body. And these channels, winds and drops go to every part of the body. But basically, a gross body and a subtle body. So that's the starting place here. Also, you could say that we have two types of mind. Although in some books it would say three, but you know, let's just say two. We can handle two. In the same definitions or delineations here, there is a gross mind that we're using, and then there is a subtle mind. A subtle mind. With these two sets of bodies and two sets of minds. Now, we're not saying we've got two mental consciousnesses. We're not saying that. What we're saying is we've got the gross mind that we use, and this mind can become quite subtle. Okay, do you see what I'm saying? So it's not like two types of minds. Although there's two types, like the gross body and the subtle body, when it comes to mind, although you say two types of mind, we're not saying there's two mental consciousnesses. We're not saying that. But there is the gross manifestation of mind, and then there's a subtle manifestation of mind. With these two types of mind, with these two types of bodies, we enact our life. We engage with the world, driven by the laws of karma. Right? That's what drives us. Death in Buddhism, very clear. When the mind separates from the body, that's death. When the mind separates from the body, that is death. Okay. When the mind separates from the body, as the body is dying, the mind becomes more and more and more subtle. So the mind that separates from the body is the subtlest type of mind, shorn of all concepts, shorn of a lot of baggage, this mind. This mind then enters what's called the bardo, this intermediate state before birth. And the bardo is described in many books. Some of the books, there's some slight differences, but basically it can be quite a dark place, it can be quite intimidating. Overriding emotion of people in the bardo tends to be fear and grasping. Fear of not knowing where they are, fear of the projections that come from their own mind, but seeing them as separate entities coming at you, like a nightmare. And grasping after a body, this intermediate state. Now you can stay in this intermediate state for seconds through to 40, 48 days, 49 days, okay? It could be very, very fast, or it can stay for as long as 49 days. In that time, the bardo being, which is what we would be, is really searching, trying to avoid problems, being frightened and searching for a new body, this grasping at a new body. Because this mind is quite subtle, it also has quite a few powers. So the bardo being can transport itself to anywhere it wants to be. Yes, if you want to go and visit your teacher, you can go. If you want to go and see your family, you have these kind of powers. You also have clairvoyant powers. It's quite a subtle mind, this. Now, whatever training you have, if you have some training in dealing with the bardo, fine. If not, then you can say, it is said that the type of being you're going to be reborn as, you have the body appears, it's not solid, it's made of light, but it appears as a kind of 7-8-year-old child, or a 7-8-year-old, if it was going to be human, like a 7 or 8-year-old child. Some books say in the gender that you're going to be. With me so far? Yeah, it's a good day. Then they say what happens is, as the bardo being is grasping after a body, it's drawn to, karmically drawn to certain couples. And it's said that they see these couples making love. They see their prospective mother and father making love. And the bardo being enters through the crown of the father's head, down through the central channel, and then out through the semen as the father ejaculates into the mother. From then on, the development is exactly as the scientists say. Exactly as the scientists say. Now, there's been an awful lot written about this. When you read it, you will notice some differences. You will notice some differences. But what tends to be very, very clear is that this is not a pleasant place to be, especially if you're unaware where you are. It can be very frightening. And this grasping after a body is very, very strong. Grasping is very strong. If you haven't found a body within 7 days, there's a mini-death in the bardo, a mini-death, and a rebirth. And you get another 7 days. This is what's said. Now, what we have to say is, who is saying this, right? This is what we've got to ask ourselves. Well, who is saying this is the high-level tantric practitioners who are using their powers to experience the death process, including the bardo process, and they're reporting back. And the reporting back tends to be very, very similar. Very, very similar. People, so it really comes from Tantra, this knowledge comes from Tantra and tantric practitioners. It also comes from people who have memories of past lives and memories of being in the bardo. This is not like this year or last year. We're talking 25 centuries of consistent teachings here. But where does it come from? Because it seems quite outstanding, really. But this is where it's coming from. It's coming from tantric practitioners. Now, why should we listen to tantric practitioners? Because part of tantra practice is to put yourself through the death process every day. I mean, ordinary practitioners every day, but some tantric practitioners, this is their main practice. And they can make their minds quite subtle and go through a type of bardo. And this is what they're reporting back. Tantric practitioners can practice this type of thing even through sleep. Because the process of death, especially the first four processes, is exactly the same as what happens to the body and mind as you fall asleep. And so practitioners start to try and fall asleep watchfully. And they start to notice the process. And they can hijack that process and project it forward into the full death state and into the bardo and practice there. Some practice to the clear light stage, and we'll come on to that, to a certain stage, and some also include the bardo. So really I'm saying this because this is not coming from a fairy tale, it's coming from practitioners who have developed their minds in such a state, and this is what they're reporting back on. also coming from people who have memories of this. In the West, you know, don't you, that there's a big difficulty in when someone dies. People, I mean, I remember starting nursing in 1972 and they weren't clear then. They drew up a list of criteria, you know. But basically, it's when the breath stops. And if the breath stops for 3 minutes or so, person's dead. Yes? From a Buddhist point of view, no, death has not occurred yet. Because the subtle breath that goes with the subtle body can be continuing for minutes, hours, and even days. Even days. So this has ramifications for practice. And you must have read many cases of people who have been revived after being pronounced dead in the West for many, you know, often. And they've been revived. So the Western criteria for death, difficult. You can't say, well, they could put you on machines, yeah, to measure brain activity, etc. Still you're not sure. And let's face it, 9 times out of 10, in fact, 99 times out of 100, they won't do that. They'll look at your age, they'll look at your condition, they'll look at the fact you've stopped breathing. You're dead. It's only really if you end up in intensive care or a good cardiothoracic ward that they'll make further tests. Okay? You're all sitting there going, oh God. Yes. Each stage of death is clearly marked. Clearly marked. So practitioners, if they practice falling asleep mindfully, can actually, it's actually quite exciting, even if you get the first stage and you recognise the first stage and you fall asleep then, you know, sometimes. But if you can catch the first four stages, what tantric practitioners do is they catch all the stages. Now, how can they do that? They can do that because each stage is clearly marked. The teachings are very clear. There is an external manifestation on each stage that you can feel, that others can see. And there's an internal vision which you experience. And these visions, I mean, I won't say they don't vary, but they are the same. They might be a bit intense on one, a bit light on another, but actually they're exactly the same. So how can you hijack this process? You can hijack this process through understanding the stages. If you understand the stages and you know what to feel, you know what you're feeling, you can see what, in fact, it's very helpful when you see it in other people too, because you know what stage they're at. But also you have the internal vision that comes to you. And if you've practiced in this, you can actually say, ah, stage one, earth element going. Limbs very heavy and loose. You know? You can do that all the way through the stages. And if you can do that through the stages, then you can control your fear. You can control attachment. There's a lot of things you can learn to control. And if you've got some practice that you can do, there's a chance. Because as you go through the process, at the end of this process, before the bardo, there's a state called clear light. Clear light. Meaning clear light, but clear light stage. And at that stage, your mind is very clear. I mean, it's probably the most pristine it will be. And what yogic practitioners do is instead of that then going on to the bardo, they hijack it. They stop it there. Because their mind is so pristine, they then do their practice at that stage. And because their mind is so clear, space-like, nothing encompassing, they can actually achieve enlightenment at that stage. And that's what yoga practitioners do. You know, people that actually take, not everybody does highest yoga tantra, unless they're into it, but proper yogis who really go for it, that's what they do. They'll learn each stage, they feel it, they know what they're feeling, And because the first four stages are mimicked in sleep, they practice dream yoga. Very interesting. Very interesting. Okay. Now, when the mind, when the most subtle mind leaves the body, there are certain things that you can see. Now, I have to say, having been with many people who are dying and dead, it doesn't always happen. But what can happen is a kind of discharge through the nose, a kind of red blob, kind of red mucusy. That's what it's always looked like to me. It's never looked like blood, it's always looked like red mucus. That's a sign that the consciousness has left the body. There is a white discharge through the sex organ. That's also a sign. The smell of decay, if you're sensitive to it, it's in the almost immediate,
yeah.
Like that. That, you know, you can get someone who's been dying a long time and the odour is a certain odour. The moment that the consciousness have left, the decay is very, very, you know, you can tell it, it's completely different. And so with high lamas, yoga practitioners, people leave the body alone until these signs are seen. Because they don't want to disturb the body. And in India, many high lamas, knowing that the time is close because of their practice, they can feel what's happening, get themselves into a meditation posture, either sitting up or on the lion's recumbent posture, the lion posture, on their right-hand side, and go into deep meditation. And His Holiness has talked about, Alan Walls has talked, Rinpoche has talked about, high yogic practitioners who are in, who are dead, by all appearances, dead. No pulse, no nothing, but sweet smelling. No change in colour. Nothing. And then something changes. And people know the consciousness has left. Sometimes in India, Alan Walls was telling me that when that happens, sometimes the monks in the different monasteries invite the local population in to walk around and have a look, just to show them what's been going on, that this is possible. It happens. And I know His Holiness and Alan Walls have been trying to get together for a while, so that so someone who's dying, you know, some high practitioner, obviously he's got a cap, so that they take, you know, readings of the brain and everything whilst this person's dying. But seemingly His Holiness has sanctioned that. So there's a lot of experiments going on to see what's going on. People are very interested in that. Any questions so far? You see the overview.
Now, you mentioned that you might have a vision of yourself in the future, a life as an 8-year-old.
Some books say that.
So some, if you were going to be in a different realm, would you have a vision of...
Doesn't say. Okay. Doesn't say. It's interesting. It didn't say. I've read so many different...
I wonder why 8-year-olds.
Don't know.
Yeah.
I honestly don't know. But it's like a young child. It's a young child, yes. 7, 8, that type of age.
Thank you.
Yeah. All of this is explained in depth in books and in texts, so it's worth looking at. But that's the overall picture. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, in his book Advice on Dying, and if you've not read that, very worthwhile. Not a big book, but a really good book. It's called Advice on Dying. What ruins this precious human rebirth and keeps us circling in samsara is really this seeing permanence instead of impermanence. Self-cherishing. And this was his advice on dying. Meditate on impermanence, first of all. You know, this will cut the bonds. Reduce, get rid of self-cherishing, and then build your compassion. And in dying, these three things, he said, will cut the root of samsara. It cuts the bonds of karma. And it's interesting because I've seen that in other contexts, but he made a special note on his advice on dying. Impermanence. Get rid of self-cherishing and compassion. And he said, these are the type of things that will help you cut the bonds, especially in the fact when you're actually dying. And he said, actually, it cuts the roots of all of the unhappy states. All of the unhappy states. Now, if you're going to help yourself and others with death, the idea of death, then you've got to overcome, we've got to overcome this idea that we're immortal. Now, I know, we're all sitting here going, I don't think I'm immortal. I know. But it's difficult to imagine everybody coming to your funeral, while it's very easy to imagine going to everybody else's funeral. Isn't it? Yeah. And if we were to look around this room and say, who's going to die first? We've all got these preconceptions there. I'm sure I'd be a candidate right up there, right? It wouldn't be you. Like impermanence and seeing permanence, this idea of immortality, this idea that everybody else is going to die except me, it's not that you cognize it that way. It's not like that. It's that feeling. Yeah, it's not going to happen to me. Not going to happen to me. Or it means not for an awful long time. So now...
Very interesting. When I discussed my clients about having a will, which is, you know, as I say to them, it's nothing to do with you dying, it's who you leave behind, and all the rubbish that has to be sorted out. And, you know, some who are highly intelligent, earning lots of money, say, no, I won't do that, because it'll bring my death forward.
There's a lot of superstition about that. Absolutely. Yeah.
And they mean it.
Oh, but of course.
Yeah, so I said, absolutely fine. Yeah.
Of course. Because we have certain preconceived ideas in our head, and this makes us behave in a certain way. And we all know we're going to die. We all know it. But this idea of permanence goes even deeper than what we were discussing before. I will die eventually. Never comes eventually. Never comes. Never comes. Now, what I'd like you to think is this. How do people generally respond to the idea of their own death? Just think about it. It tends to be a binary thing, but when you've talked to people about death, I don't mean just generally, their own death, your death, what type of responses do people usually give? Just think about that. If you've ever had this conversation with someone or it's come up, how did they react? How did they react? Because we need to know this and we need to bring it up front. How did they react? What do you think? How do people generally react when the idea of their own mortality comes, even if it's just in conversation?
Shocked.
How could you say that to me? Yes? The one thing you know is going to happen.
I got told I was morbid.
Yes.
So I was leaving my last job and I went to somebody who didn't know I was a Buddhist. I said, oh, see you later. And she said, oh, maybe not. And I said, I'll see you in the next life. And then she went, oh, that's so morbid. I was like, all right. Which I probably shouldn't have said that, but I just sort of, you know, said it.
It's true. How else?
People don't want to talk about it.
Really don't?
Change the subject.
Absolutely, change the subject. Not everyone. It's interesting. I've worked with death in hospices and in hospitals. Not everyone. But certainly, I mean, I've had patients that wanted to talk about it and family that wouldn't allow them. Kept changing. They were the ones that kept changing the topic.
Yeah.
How else?
Fearful.
Fear, yeah.
And just nervous and uncomfortable about it.
Very nervous, very uncomfortable. And there tends to be, there's a tendency to say, yes, I'm going to die, but it's going to be a long time away, you know, in the far, you know, future. How far? Far enough until they're comfortable. Far enough until they're comfortable.
I also hear things like, I'm not worried about dying. It's the way I die mm-hmm. that I'm worried about. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. They're not worried about death, but the way they die.
Yeah.
That's right. And that's, apart from the fear and pushing things back and changing the topic, I find the people who say that to me, the way they die, and of course I understand that. That makes sense. I've been with a lot of dying people. I'm there. I dying is the most pleasant of experiences. But there is an attitude about quite a big group of people of quite blasé about it. Oh yeah, we're going to die. What's the problem? You know. And then change the subject. So there's often this binary thing of fear, pushing it away to a far, far distant past. But there's also this, yeah, of course I'm going to die. Everybody's going to die. What's the big deal? Everybody's going to die. This kind of blasé approach. And that's actually more difficult to deal with. Have you ever come across anyone like that?
Yeah. I'd say that's the norm, to be honest. Unless as people get older, then that seems to change a little bit. Because they then perceive it's getting closer.
Much closer. That does have an impact, certainly.
But again, you know, I've had, not personal experience, but I've heard of people wanting to talk about death.
Yes.
And feeling very isolated. Because
yes.
Friends won't talk about it.
Yes.
Family won't talk about it. The doctors don't have time. And they just left in limbo.
Yes, absolutely. That's happened. You know, I see that happening all the time. And in fact, what I've found on quite a few occasions is the dying individual ends up comforting the relatives and behaving and saying certain things, not because they're trying to resolve issues within themselves, but they're trying to keep them calm. So these people are lying to the person who's dying. You're looking great. You'll make it to Christmas. We're going to have a great time. Complete lies, all of it. The person who's dying, yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. Yeah, it happens. People lie to you when you're dying.
And sometimes you get both sides wanting to talk about it, but I think it's the wrong thing to do.
Yeah.
I've read several books on nurses and hospice, and they will have the parents saying, we don't want to discuss, especially with children, anything in front of our daughter about dying, because we want to be positive. Mm. And when the nurse talks to the daughter said, I really want to just bring this out to the open and say, I know I'm dying, it's not going to change. And then it's the skill of the nurse to...
Yes, yeah. Yeah, if you're lucky enough to be in a hospice, that can well be mediated, definitely. You have to be careful, though, eh? You have to be careful to listen to what the dying person is saying. That's the skill. If the dying person says, I'm all right, aren't I? It's possible I could get better, isn't it? That person doesn't want to hear that they're dying. Right?
Yeah.
They know. But they don't want to hear it. They don't want to discuss. If that same person, though, says to you things like, I'm on my way out, aren't I? I think I'm dying. What do you think? This person wants to discuss. So there's lots of skills there. But personally, I've had more trouble with family than with people who are dying. It's about stepping out of this state of self-imposed permanence, which brings nothing but suffering from the moment you're born to trying to die well. Can't do it. It's taking that step out of permanence into the impermanence. Really. And the sooner you step out of this self-imposed delusion of permanence, and the sooner impermanence is making more logical sense, making more intellectual sense, and you're beginning to work with it, death is a wee bit easier to cope with. Can be easier to cope with.
Both with other people, watching other people dying as well as yourself? Because I feel kind of fine about that process. But watching, I've never really watched somebody who I really love die, so that scares me a bit.
It's very hard. It's extremely hard. But knowing and being real with people and being honest, if the person wants honesty, there's no use imposing honesty on someone that doesn't want it. That only disturbs the mind, and the one thing you can't do or you shouldn't do is disturb the dying person's mind. But sometimes in a death situation, especially in hospitals, not in hospice so much, but hospitals, the doctors and the nurses are doing more to calm down the relatives than to actually minister to the person who's dying. And that's very... I mean, you have a responsibility to the relatives, for sure. But your main responsibility is the person that's dying. But it's a very strange tightrope to walk. But just be aware, when you're dying, people lie to you. Just be aware. You know, when His Holiness and other great teachers ascend a throne to do teaching... You've seen them on videos, maybe? They ascend a throne. And before they sit down, they snap their fingers. Snap their fingers and sit down. And that's to remember impermanence. Emptiness. Impermanence. Like that. You'll often see, if you ever watch a video of His Holiness ascending the throne and sitting down, you'll see all the teachers do that. Sometimes they don't make a big show of it, but they always do that. To remind, it's so important, they remind themselves of impermanence. To help others. Everybody wants to help others. When we talk about death, people say, how do I help others? How do I help others? Yes? They all want to know that. But you see, unless you can help yourself, chances of you helping others are very slim. Very slim. Now, one of the main ways of helping yourself, be mindful of death, has been handed down through centuries. It's called the 9-point death meditation. And I'd like you to, thank you, I'd like you to quickly look at that. The whole point of this 9-point death meditation is one of the primary practices, the primary meditations, is to bring this strong awareness of death within your mind. Now, even if you're a practitioner, even if you're working with impermanence, still, if we look around and we see who's going to die first, you know, you can categorize everybody, couldn't you? She looks a bit dodgy, you know. I saw, you know, he looks a bit, you know, and that bit. And you might say to yourself, I'm in there somewhere, but I bet you, in reality, you're right at the end. See, what you have to do is to live with death. Death has got to be preeminent. Why? Because of impermanence. And because you can rely on death. It's never going to let you down, dear. Never going to let you down. It's going to happen. And so, death becomes For a Buddhist practitioner, death is front and centre. Death and impermanence, front and centre. And all the great lamas, Rinpoche says, a day without thinking about and meditating on death is a day wasted. Wasted. Now, people think, hey, oh my God, how morbid. How morbid is that? But it's not. It's actually about giving us energy to practice, energy to see the impermanent nature. And so, instead of thinking, I'll be the last man standing, we tend to think it could happen at any time. Really. And I often tell the story of the first retreat I ever led, a weekend retreat on Lam Rim, and we were doing, I think there was about, I don't know, about 12, 14 people. And we were doing the death meditations, and people wanted more, so we were doing more and more death meditations. And at the end of it, one young man said, you know, I feel we should have brought a coffin with us. Because who's to say one of us wouldn't die? That's how, you know, the meditations really got to him. And he thought, oh, interestingly, as young as he was the first person to die of that group. Interesting. So what am I saying? I'm saying death has got to be with us at all times, really. This reminding yourself about death, but not to be depressed. If it's going to depress you and stop you practicing the Lam Rim, then just leave it to one side for a while until you're mentally more fit, okay? But if you're mentally okay, right, then keep it with you. Keep it with you. When you're meeting something, every situation, if you're studying, if you're actually meditating on death a lot and you've taken that aspect of the Lam Rim, every time you meet someone, you're thinking, this could be the last time I see this person because I could be dead. Do you think that would influence how you behaved? What you said? It would. This could be the last meal I have. There's nothing to say that I won't stand up after this meal and drop down dead. I bet you eat that meal quite mindfully. It becomes very, very powerful. Now, this 9-point death meditation has three roots, and each root has three parts. Here can be the difficulty. You're meditating. Our death is death, nothing can prevent it. Tick. Next, our life is bound to increase. Well, I know that. Death will come regardless. That's fine. Okay. And that's what can happen. Unless we take this 9 points and enrich it with how we really feel. Not just knowledge, but how we feel. We tend to be governed by our senses, by our feelings. If we were guided by logic, we'd actually do very well. But we're not. Okay? So what we're going to do after the break is three groups. Each group is going to look at a different route. And I want you to discuss, how can I enrich, what can I add to each of these points that would enrich the meditation I'm going to do? Do you see why? Because otherwise it's, our death is definite, nothing can prevent it. Yes, you can hold that in your mind for a bit. But unless you can bring something to the party, your fears, your anxieties, what's happened in the past, what could happen in the future, how you really feel about that, then it becomes just a meaningless exercise. So after the break, we're going to split into three, and that's what I'd like you to do. Does that make any sense? Can you see? It cannot afford to be dry. It needs to be moist. So we'll take our break a wee bit early, and I'll see you back here at 5 o'clock. And then, death. I'll stay here. Yeah, thank you.